special treat for you today, a gentleman who is a real pantheon in his field, Robert Middlecoff, joining now, author of Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. And Robert, the first thing I want to do is welcome you to Book Corner today. Great to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's great to be on your program.
Robert, as we look at George Washington and his life, and I was telling you before we got started here today that I'm not a tremendous student of history. As I read your work, I wish I was more of a student of history, and I think you're going to pull a person like me with your work into going deeper into this subject of the founding of our country, going back to the origins, and the Washington story and the way it just all came about is one amazing story. As we say, you could not make this up if you tried.
I agree. I don't think you could.
Why is Washington's story, this many years later, still so compelling to somebody like you?
Well, I suppose there's a kind of inherent interest and attractiveness to it. In some ways, it has the elements of a typical American story. He does not start out, after all, with all the advantages of the world. He's in a second-level Virginia family. Of course, that's better than most, but still, he's not born to the purple. He's not a member of the gentry. His family isn't. His father dies when he's young. He has a mother who is uneducated, even in 18th century terms, and that is, she's barely literate. And it's a difficult childhood in lots of ways. And his rise comes through a good deal of effort, and in his case, of course, through war, the French and Indian War, as it's called in America, or the Seven Years' War in Europe. So that's one of the things. His involvement in two wars, the War of the Revolution being the second, and also the complexity of the society in which he entered. It's a slaveholding society in some ways with very dreadful features. So there's a lot that he has to learn. And in the wars, there's a lot that he has to endure. It's not a simple set of challenges he faces. His life is really full of challenges. I suppose that's the principal reason that we're still interested in him. It's, in a way, it describes the very general terms, the fate of all American youth, whatever they are.
And you're an individual yourself. You served in Korea and Japan. Also, you were a lieutenant in the U.S. Marine Corps. You've had this burning interest in history for the better part of your adult life, a teaching career at Cal Berkeley back in the 60s. You went on to chair the history department there. You did so many things. And yet, we continue to come back to Washington. As you do a work like this, do you find yourself learning as you continue to dig, even with as much as you've written about the Revolution? Are there things that you learned as you put this work together?
Oh, yes. By no means have I mastered all the sources of early American history or the history that goes into the Revolution. I learned an awful lot. I had to learn a good deal about, just go down the list, I had to learn a good deal about military history and about the 18th century military, both in Europe and in America. I had to learn more than I knew about the lives of both Indian and black people, especially about slavery. Certainly haven't mastered either of those subjects. I had to learn about earthy things as tobacco planting, the growing of wheat, the connections in trade between America and and Britain, how they worked. Had to learn a lot about the British ministry and the British Parliament. I could make this list much longer, but those are samples of things that I had certainly to learn.
Yeah, there are so many layers and layers and layers to George Washington's story, to the birth of our nation. All these moving parts, as you talk about. And I go back to your first chapter where you talk about the making of a soldier and his time in Virginia. And I know that Americans, several believe that the providence of God was hand was on the birth of our nation. You look at the way this guy was prepared. You look at how he comes, as you say, not from royal bloodlines per se, but from semi-humble beginnings. He finds his way into that first conflict that you talked about, which took place over in the Ohio Valley, which was then known as New Canada, the part of that was under the French occupation. And he's sort of drafted into that, finds his way into that. But he displays his leadership skills pretty early on there, doesn't he? Yet he's humbled by that experience. If you could expound on that.
Well, he does certainly display his potential as a leader. He also made a good many mistakes over there. He was responsible for choosing the defensive position against the French in 1754 at Great Meadows, where the force under his command, about 400 men, really take a pretty severe beating by the French. He's, I think, largely responsible for that. He learned a lot in such affairs. There was something that really, in his presence, maybe that's the best way of putting it, that made men look at him differently. They realized that this young man really had something rather special. There were visible signs of it. He was a big person, a large man, tall, good-looking, very graceful in his movements. He was a superb horseman. He had a lot of the accomplishments that men recognized and valued. There was always that. Then there was the fact that he showed in the way he dealt with people that though he was very strong and very tough, he was also very fair-minded. The correspondence of the time, you know, people find people saying that he's ever dishonest or tricky or slippery. He's what old-fashioned Americans would call a straight shooter. He's really got something that we, I think, more generally call character, and that's apparent to these people. Though there were times when settlers were very angry with him because he couldn't provide the protection that they needed, they still, I think, held him in respect. And though he absorbed a lot of bruises, he came through it a much stronger and an even more impressive young man.
So he's a straight shooter, yet he also has a savvy quality about him. He gets frustrated with different parts of the militia that he's called to lead. He's frustrated. He is able to verbalize these frustrations. One thing I took away from him, in a way that's not off-putting to his superiors, and even going on to his time as he starts to lead the forces in the Revolutionary War, but we're now still back in his militia days, he was able to verbalize his frustrations in a way where he was able to actually affect change, wasn't he, rather than repel people. And I guess that's a great sign of leadership, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. I think you're absolutely right about that. Well, commanders at that time, and he was the commander of the Virginia Regiment, a militia, commanders were in close quarters with their men. That was one thing that if the commander was honest and responsible and was really demonstrably interested in his men, as Washington was, that came through. He put on no airs. He wasn't a fancy man at all. And when they were struggling, he was struggling. If they were ill-fed, he was ill-fed. So he, by his conduct, his behavior, his self-discipline, I think he earned the confidence of a lot of people, the most crucial being, of course, the men that he was leading. He was also willing to take some chances. He had, for a while in the early 50s, a difficult British governor, Robert Dinwiddie was his name, to deal with. And he was quite forceful in explaining the difficulties that he was facing in the frontier, that he really needed more weapons, he needed better support, he needed to get these men paid at times, and the government was slow in doing that. So in his open and honest advocacy of these people, I think he earned their respect. He was pretty impressive in doing that.
And so then he goes into more domesticated life after that, and he becomes a planter, and he takes on the role of a farmer and a husband, and he gains a couple of children by way of marriage through all that. How does this time help to prepare him for what is coming?
Well, that's an awfully good question. The period that you're alluding to is a very difficult one and yet a deeply satisfying one for him. He takes on as the owner, proprietor of Mount Vernon and the farms and plantations that made up his holdings. He took on a lot of responsibility, not just for his planting duties, that is, putting in a crop. And he was looked upon by his neighbors because of his obvious new wealth that came to him with his marriage to Martha Washington as a kind of natural leader who had to be interested in and had to take some responsibilities for some of the problems of his neighbors. And they did come to him. If they needed advice, they often turned to him. And in the middle of the 1750s, they started electing him to the local legislature, the House of Burgesses. But even had they not done that, they would have looked to him for advice and help in all kinds of ways. There were cases of widows, for example, who were having trouble claiming the estates of their deceased husbands. He took on a number of such cases. He wasn't a lawyer, but he was a pretty strong advocate to help these women along the way to gain the values of their estates so that they had some means of support. So in a whole multitude of ways, he was really a good citizen, a very responsible one. And I think that helped mature him. I think he learned more about what most people have to go through and just getting through the days and getting through their lives, raising their children. All these things he took in the right way. He never shirked his duties, his local duties, his responsibilities as a neighbor in effect. And they were special responsibilities and came to him almost naturally because he was a man of great wealth by this time and also because he was a very willing servant of his friends and of his neighbors. He came through when he was needed. And as I say, I think that really it does help mature him.
He was a remarkable guy, yet at the same time, we talk about some of his failings. He showed his flaws, yet he didn't let his flaws define him, which I guess that's a great part of leadership. You talk about in the book how he lives with a self-awareness that helps set him apart as well. Let me ask you about the concept of awareness in that time period. How are those that are in charge that ultimately will decide who to appoint where and how Washington ends up leading our revolution and becoming one of the great leaders in the founding of our world and our country? How does Washington come on the radar? You don't have the way of communicating that we have today. We don't have television to say this is the next hot candidate, or radio, or even in those days we didn't even have a tremendous amount of newspapers. So how do they know of this man, George Washington?
Well, that's another good question. I suppose the principal element in his life that brought him to the attention not just to other Virginians but to people in the other colonies was the war. The fact that he was, as a very young man, the leader of a great militia all of the colonies were involved in the war against the French in the 1750s, right up to its end in 1763. The word got around that there was a very able leader in Virginia, and so in a way, through the difficulties of the war and constant fighting and struggling, at least, news of the existence of Washington spread. He also wrote a little account of one of his encounters with, very early on, with the French, in which he says he hears the bullets whistle by his ear. I'm paraphrasing now. This isn't a close quote, but, and there was something charming in the sound. Well, this got into print. It was printed, and actually it was printed in Europe, in Britain, as well as in America. The King, George, reportedly said, well, if he had heard more of them, or perhaps he would not have been so charmed with the sound. Well, that sort of thing, I think, it's a kind of fame. Maybe it's a transitory fame, but this war was very important, after all. And so that sort of thing, I think, helped get his name spread around. And then in the agitation against what the British were doing in the empire that followed the Seven Years' War, the period from about 1763 or 4 to the fighting up in New England at Lexington and Concord in 1775. During that period, there was a lot of agitation and discussion of what the British were doing in America. They were attempting to tax the Americans for revenue, which they had never done before. They'd never collected a tax since the founding for revenue that could be used for strictly English purposes. The colonies had contributed in their own way. They had taxed themselves. Washington was among the people who wrote and protested against British actions after 1763. And he put his name to a number of documents that helped rally the colonists in opposition to the British changes or reforms, things that were regarded as being oppressive in America. And by the time the First Continental Congress met in September of 1774, he was known, quite well known, as a military figure. And at the Congress, I think just through private conversations and appearance and the solidity and stability of his judgments that went through to or got through to the representatives from other colonies who were there in Philadelphia at the First Continental Congress. And so when things really got tough in 1774 and 1775, he was a known figure, and he had something that nobody else really had among the Americans. He had a military reputation as well as a reputation for being a very strong individual and a man of responsibility and stability. So if you read the letters of other members of that First Continental Congress, they're all able men who their comments about how strong Washington was in every way, that sort of assessment really does get around. So when push came to shove in 1775 with the battles of Lexington and Concord and really armed resistance, there wasn't much doubt that the ablest American militarily was George Washington.
And we forward now to July 3rd of 1775, and he takes over command of the army. And right from the very beginning, he's beset with a bunch of challenges I don't think today we can comprehend. We're so used to seeing a mighty military today, even in the times that we live in where we talk about cutbacks in the military. We're talking about, in his day, his soldiers going without provisions, his soldiers going without shoes, his soldiers going without or with ragtag uniforms. And he's constantly having to petition the Congress and the government of the time, we need more. These guys are laying it on the line for us here. And then Robert, against that backdrop, he's got leakage from his own military, guys that are half in, half out. And he has to impress upon them. See, he's playing two sides now. He's got those above him that he's got to say, hey, we've got to show these guys our appreciation. And then these guys that aren't being appreciated, he's telling them, look, if we don't fight here and we don't win, your wives and your children are going to be turned over to these people. And this is not going to be pretty, let alone what they're going to do to you if you're captured. It's a real mess there, isn't it?
Yes. And the situation that you describe persisted throughout the revolution. The army was always without the weapons it needed. It was always without the food, the rations that it needed. It needed virtually everything. Everything was always in short supply, including pay for these people. That was another thing that I think was a very serious problem, that people were giving up everything to serve in the army, and many of these men, after all, had families, and they needed support, and yet they weren't being paid the rather miserable wages that ordinary soldiers received in the 18th century. So it was a very, very difficult time, and he does spend a great deal of time talking with congressional committees. The army is visited by committees, investigative committees. Congress got a very early start on that. And he deals with these people always with, I think, a good deal of responsibility. And he's a very powerful advocate for his soldiers. That brings up one other question you probably were going to get to, maybe I'll anticipate it, but he respected civilian authority. This wasn't a war that was going to end in a dictatorship or an American monarchy, as far as he was concerned. This was a war for a Republican government, Republican with a small r, a representative government, with its people free and its representatives held responsible for what they were doing. So even during the worst of times, when the army was terribly suffering, he recognized that congressional authority was the supreme authority in the land. He wanted it increased, as a matter of fact, leadership or anything approached an old monarchy or anything dictatorial. He was the commander of the army, and it was always going to be, as far as he was concerned, a responsible army under civilian direction. That I found one of the most impressive things about him.
And it was a real tightrope he walked the entire time. One thing's for sure, you talk about this in the front of the book, and it bears out, when you look at Washington compared to his counterparts of the opposition, Howe, some of the other guys, some of the folks over on the mainland, he is just superior to those folks in the way he navigated, his decision making, his leadership. He's just a superior figure. And let me say this, we're visiting today with Robert Middlecoff. His book I recommend to you, Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. It is available from Alfred A. Knopf, and it is well worth the read. Robert, in the front of the book, you talk about the superiority of Washington compared to his counterparts, yet they have so many more weapons. They have so much more firepower, yet he's able to hold this ragtag group together long enough to eventually get some help from the French and eventually went out. It's remarkable all the ways he was being attacked, as I said before, from behind, from above, from the British, just all these forces pulling at him, and he just shows tremendous leadership.
Indeed he does, and all of those factors that you're citing, I think, are certainly very important. I think one thing that should also be mentioned with real seriousness is that the aid from the French proved to be very, very important. It was in several ways, near the end of the war and near the last great battle, of course, or in the last great battle, the French provided very important troops at Yorktown, and they also had a navy, which presence really keep the possibility of British support at a distance. They protected the combined Franco-American force at Yorktown. Besides that, in less dramatic ways, the French were very important in providing a good deal of money for the payment of troops and supplies that had to be purchased to arm the troops. And they were also important diplomatically. They were in some ways very effective in Europe. They helped bring the Spanish in 1779. It's true that the Spanish Empire really did not help a great deal, but at least they presented one more obstacle for the British to have to deal with or think about in Europe, especially because the Spanish had a very large navy. There are outside sources of support that Washington had that he certainly appreciated them, and he proved to be a very shrewd diplomat in dealing with the French. The French sometimes felt the doubts that a lot of people did about the American future, the possibility of the Americans caving in or surrendering or just being overpowered. The French had good many fears about that. Washington helped deal with those fears, and so, in fact, did Benjamin Franklin as the American ambassador, the American minister in Paris. So it is a complicated diplomatic situation, but it does see Washington showing another side of his talents in dealing with the French, who had, after all, been the ancient enemy for a long time and now were the allies of the Americans.
Robert Middlecoff, one thing that your book did for me, made me feel about 2 feet tall. I got to give you full disclosure here. I grew up in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. You know what that means. I had literally had no idea, was at the Brandywine battlefield a million times as a kid, never really took it seriously. We used to go tubing and swimming in the Brandywine Creek, and I'm just thinking of all this incredible history, and your book talks about how my hometown is a place where the British soldiers encamped as they got ready for a real bloody battle there, that I think they, reading your work, they got the best of us there at Brandywine. The battlefield is still there. There are things that are still there. Isn't it amazing that we can have all that history around us? We live in this freedom, and yet somebody like me doesn't appreciate it. That must frustrate you.
Well, sounds like you do appreciate it.
I'm starting to appreciate it.
If people aren't aware, then it should be the purpose of teachers and really all of us to really come up to speed and learn more about our history. I'm sure there are great areas of American history that I know very little or nothing about, but I welcome the opportunity to learning about them.
We walk over these things every day. History's all around us, isn't it? Let me ask you just a silly question. Are artifacts from that time, do they still turn up in those banks through whatever, detectors, storms, are weapons still found, that sort of thing? I know that's a silly question, but I just had that question growing up in that area, and I'm thinking, there must be just so much around us that we don't see, if you see what I'm getting at.
Yes, I do. Well, I can't give you a very informed answer because, of course, I don't live there. I have lived both in Connecticut and Virginia, but it's been a long time. My guess is that musket balls are still found in various places in Pennsylvania. and probably along Brandywine Creek. I bet a musket ball or two turns up there fairly often for anybody digging. I don't know about other places. Well, Yorktown, there's certainly some physical evidence there that comes up now and then. Some of these places, as you know, are very well preserved, or as well preserved as can be. I think the same questions can be asked about the Civil War, and there, mm-hmm. of course, there are many more. It's a more recent event, after all, and an even bloodier one. I'm sure many things turn up there, say around Manassas. Or remember when I was in the Marines, that we looked at some were described as trenches or parts of trenches that had been dug there. Of course, that's half a century ago. Yes, there certainly is history present around us.
Hey, Robert, on the way out here, and again, congratulations on Washington's Revolution, the making of America's first leader, which is available from Alfred A. Knopf. And I encourage our listener to pick a copy of this up. What I love about your writing is that it's accessible. Your writing is not way up there, and I believe you do that on purpose for people like me. And if you're a history buff, obviously there's enough in there to grab you. But if you're someone like myself who loves great storytelling, the way you brought a multi-dimension to the character, the person of George Washington, and you tie a biography into history, I believe you did that successfully. You talked about that being your aim at the front of the book. I would love for you now to have the final word and sort of tie up our conversation.
Well, I think we've covered an awful lot of ground in this conversation. I think perhaps the only way I could really wrap things up is to say that Americans have a long and interesting history and should be proud of most of it. Every people makes mistakes, and we've had our share, but on the whole, I think it's wonderful to be an American. And we do have, as you said at the very beginning of this conversation, we do have a very rich history, and it's really deeply interesting once you get into it.
Robert, I really thank you. Really great talking to you, Robert.
Well, it's nice talking to you, Tony.
You too. Robert Middlecoff, Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. This concludes another exciting action-packed edition of Book Corner, and I thank Robert Middlecoff once again.